Blog Talk Radio.
Gaias and fans of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Thank you for tuning in and being part of the Voices of the Sacred Family, and for all your valuable feedback and comments and encouragement, some of which I'm going to share pretty soon here. But I want to say right at the top of the show, we have what you might think of as an unusual gift here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine for our Mother's Day special. I did at first, even though I certainly wanted this lady as a guest. Well, I believe in the paranormal. That's not always been the focus here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine. So this upcoming guest, Esther Luttrell, author of Dear Dean, Love Mom, well, at first glance, it didn't seem like maybe she fit our mold. But is her topic so unusual? Well, when I got to thinking, a mother connects with her son on the other side. Yes, that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. And it does fit Mother's Day, and it does fit in here at Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Well, why, you might ask? Is it not obvious to you like it wasn't obvious to me at first? Well, consider the power of a mother's unconditional love. That's often an aspect of the Sacred Feminine. And what about the tenacity of the female? Yep, that's another check mark too. The connection between goddess and her son? Okay, another reason. And what about the powers of ancient and contemporary priestesses as shaman and guardians at the crossroads between life and death? I believe this week's guest, the lovely and genuine and sincere Esther Luttrell, embodies these archetypes and practitioners. Even if some of this language we use as part of our everyday vocabulary might not be how she maybe describes herself. Esther Luttrell, author of Dear Dean, Love Mom, is the story of a woman, the love and connection she shared with her son Dean, and her paranormal experiences after his death that opened up a new paradigm for her. The fact Esther and I even connected and have become friends and colleagues is quite unusual in itself. But then, we know there are no accidents. As I read her book, I was immediately taken in by the universal web in which she is so much a part, so much an important player. She's a weaver. I was so taken, I literally, this is no joke, I literally almost missed one of Voices of the Sacred Feminine radio shows because I couldn't put her book down. It was as if she was speaking directly to me, or the great she was speaking directly to me through Esther. And that's why I invited her here on the show today to share all that with you. I believe Esther has important information for us all, so please stay tuned. I have just a few things to share before we get to our interview. And first, I want to remind you, if you've forgotten, Mother's Day is this Sunday. So please take seriously my encouragement to honor yourself, as I've been encouraging you the last few weeks. However that looks and feels to you, Roy and I are probably going to have a date on Sunday to just relax and have dinner and a movie. Maybe we'll even see Avatar again. And then remember our great mother, she of 10,000 names. Tip a glass to her, pick up some trash, throw a flower out on the waves at the beach, use reusable bags at the grocery, whatever. Maybe just say thanks and how can I help? And I want to say thanks to one of our listeners, Cecily. She shared some quick thoughts I felt you might benefit from, too. I'll just rattle some of these off because I think she makes some important points. First, she says job creation is the solution to the majority of problems worldwide if those jobs are earth-friendly. And then she wants to remind people, and I agree, about the Howard Zinn book, The People's History of the United States, one book everyone should read because it demonstrates how our earth and her people are manipulated by the divide and conquer principle, how and why wars are created and all that sort of stuff. She reminds us this mortgage crisis is only the most recent land grab in a history of land grabs, and notice mort, M-O-R-T, or death, is part of the word mortgage. It does feel like that sometimes, doesn't it? She says sexism, racism, classism, and all the other isms are a sleight-of-hand mechanism used by a small number of heartless and frightened beings. And she says she asks Mr. Fiazzi, her psychology teacher, what is this thing about power? I don't understand it. And he told her, those who are unable to receive love seek power. And finally, from Cecily, capitalism and imperialism are fear-based. And by creating a false scarcity, the majority of life on this planet is placed at odds. And I also want to share a few comments from Yona. Yona offered some feedback on our What's the Buzz segment, and as I said, I always appreciate hearing from listeners to see if they like what's happening on the show. And Yona says, thanks for standing up and speaking out against the neocon inquisition, as he calls it, that threatens to engulf America in a Disney World dark age and spread like an oil spill to pollute what remains of individual consciousness. And he says the dumbing down of America and other major industrial powers is just one element in a much more insidious and widespread plan to turn the U.S. into a carbon copy of the Roman Empire following the death of the Democratic Republic. So thank you, Yona. Thank you, Cecily, for contributing to the show and for offering your thanks and your insights. And finally, thank you, too, to Lisa Thiel, tonight's artist, who we were highlighting at the opening of the show. You were listening to a snippet from her song, Rainbow Woman, and her website is sacreddream.com. And now, for what you're going to hear at the bottom of the hour in our What's the Buzz segment, when I let those pesky bees that have been buzzing around in my bonnet out, when we share things going on around the globe and right here at home that are in sync with ideals of goddess or opposing ideals of the sacred feminine. Some of tonight's news briefs are going to be about Belgium, who's banning the burqa. Will more of Europe follow? Al-Shabaab is stoning women, men, and children in Somalia. Florida Republicans push anti-abortion legislation, and Democrats push back. Women's rights activists oppose Iran joining the UN Commission on the Status of Women. Women can serve on U.S. Navy submarines now. There's also an investigation into the Nigerian parliamentarian's marriage to a 13-year-old girl we'll talk about. And dozens of Afghan girls and their teachers are gassed in attacks at girls' schools. Hawaii approves civil unions. Walmart, not so good news for Walmart. A sex discrimination lawsuit is moving forward. And if we have time, we will talk about the 5 hours of trying to rape a lesbian straight in Africa and the next Catholic abuse scandal, crimes against women. So stay tuned with me to the bottom of the hour. We'll cover these important developments. And, of course, we're opening the show to callers who would like to call and talk to myself or Esther. That number is 718-766-4662. And I know from your emails, most of you do listen from the archives, but if you're there live with us, please do call in and say hello or offer your comments. And now to tonight's guest, Esther Luttrell, author of Dear Dean, Love Mom. Let me tell you a little bit about her before we start our chat. Esther began her career as a writer, director, producer of documentaries, educational films, and syndicated television programs in the Midwest. Later in Los Angeles, she joined the CBS script department, then MGM Studios. When her son Dean, an aspiring filmmaker himself, died, she began conducting screenwriting workshops across the country in his memory. It was then that she experienced accidental meetings with others who had lost loved ones. They sought her out. They phoned from states she'd never visited, and they all had the same question. Why do I feel compelled to meet you? Dean was at the root of those encounters. It would be years before Esther understood what it was he was trying to get across to her from the other side. That understanding is captured between the covers of her book, Dear Dean, Love Mom, a book that is not about Esther and not about Dean. It's about the message Dean wanted her to share with everyone who needs to be assured there is life after life. And after producing the feature film Lithium Springs and two World War II documentaries, she made the decision to devote her time traveling and speaking about the experiences that led her to write Dear Dean, Love Mom. She's also the author of five other books, and her screenplay, Malice in the First Degree, is in production in Miami and Puerto Rico, even as we speak. Well, Esther, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karen.
You know, honestly, and I don't say this very often, I can't remember when I have enjoyed a book so much as yours. You know, not only did it have that, you know, that added twist of, how should I say, you know, the paranormal, but it had this, it wasn't just the paranormal like, you know, the Ghostbusters on TV. It was the paranormal with a spiritual twist, with spiritual wisdom. And I think that's why it touched me so much, because I felt like you answered, you know, the question, you know, the doubt so many of us have, you know, what happens when we close our eyes and everything goes black. You know, it's we don't deal very well with our mortality here in the West. So,
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, and so I was just going to say thank you, first of all, for writing the book, because it made me feel so much better about all of that. And, you know, I guess start off by telling us, you know, how this has changed you. I mean, how talking to these people, seeing Dean, you know, let's just start with how you've changed from who you used to be to who you are today since Dean's death in this book.
Gosh, I don't know that we can analyze ourselves so clearly. I wish we could. Probably somebody else who knows me could say, boy, has she changed. They'd say, I don't see any changes at all. I don't know. I suppose if I had to analyze myself, I'd probably say that I pay a lot more attention to what people tell me now. Maybe people were telling me stories about losing their loved ones before Dean died, and I just never put any significance to it. I don't recall their stories. I don't think they did. But certainly, I mean, something just happened this past weekend that made me think, my goodness, is Dean still doing this? Because I tend to think that he's gone on to other things once I put it together and go, aha, I see, Dean, I see what you're trying to get me to tell people. And then I wrote the book. It's kind of like he went, oh, thank heavens, Mom. It took me 14 years to get it through to you. Now I've really got to get busy with everything else. So long. But something happened this weekend that made me think, well, Dean is always where he needs to be, putting us with people we need to be with so that this word can get out. So how has it changed me? Just probably made me more alert to what is the mission? Why did these things happened to me, somebody who really has no interest in sci-fi, certainly, mm-hmm. and who has never delved deeply into the paranormal. I don't had a friend who believed in Ouija boards, and he drove me crazy. I've just been very, very, I assumed from the time I can remember assuming that we were certainly not the only life among the billions of galaxies. I always assume that. I never can remember a time when I didn't assume that we were one of many living planets. But that doesn't mean that I read sci-fi. That just seemed like logic. That seemed like common sense. You know
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, because it's almost unthinkable that we are the only the only life in the cosmos. That's just arrogant.
Yeah. And as we get better pictures of what's out there, and we see that, you know, we're simply a germ on a speck on the end of a gnat's nose, I don't think we're the ultimate in anything. Heaven help us if anybody thinks that there's nobody out there as evolved as we are. I would imagine we look pretty primitive to many, many other types of life. I also get tickled when they say things like, well, there can't be life there because, and they start naming the elements that you would need to sustain life. That's like me saying, oh, I don't believe anybody could walk barefoot in the jungle because I can't. You know,
right,
it hurts.
Right. Well, and that's also assuming
that live with
their
solid eyes, you know.
Well, right, and that's also assuming that we know what conditions somebody else would need to live, that we're assuming they would be exactly like us.
Yes, they would evolve into whatever they need to survive on whatever their conditions are. So it's also, I think we're just so absurdly cocky about all of this. But I think I got far away from your question of how did you change.
Well, that's okay, because, you know, it all sort of parallels and overlaps.
It does.
You know, I was gonna just say to you that it would not surprise me in the least that all these documentaries we see on TV about alien astronauts we would absolutely find proof of that one day.
They think that we haven't? I can't believe this. There are so many documented cases, you know, from certainly creditable people. Even Carter saw a UFO.
Right.
You know,
right.
A UFO is only unidentified.
Right. Well, and these are very credible people. It's not some drunk nut job or something.
Yeah. And it's gone on for, you know, since recorded time, and even before recorded time, if you call paintings and caves recordings, I don't know. It's just absurd. And
the Von Daniken stuff too. You know, the artifacts that look like people in spaceships and things like that. You know, it's just too. Again, it's right there in plain sight. But you know, I think it's our fear. Our fear is what stops us from, you know, crawling outside this little box that some of us, you know, want to live in. But I think that's what you're going to help us do tonight, Esther. You're going to help us crawl outside that box some of us live in and help us expand our awareness about what you think is happening on the other side, what you've learned from Dean. And I remember, you know, the very beginning of your book, you really just grabbed me in the beginning because you talked about how seeing the ghost of your grandfather, not until you were older.
Be careful how you use that word ghost, because don't forget, he was this three-dimensional. I didn't know he wasn't living and breathing right there beside my grandma.
Well, tell that story, please.
Well, I don't know that it's much of a story, Karen. Is it really interesting? Gosh.
Oh, I think so.
I think
it is really. Yeah, absolutely.
But just tell about what? When I'd go to my grandma's house, then she had, it was really a two-room duplex, very, very pretty on Bayshore Boulevard in Tampa. Big, beautiful old home that was divided into a fourplex. And so when you walk in, there was a big feather bed over to the right next to a huge window. And then along the left wall was a sofa. And I'd love to get this little step stool, climb into that big feather bed, sit in the middle of it, and play with her button box when I was little. So Grandma and Mom would sit on the couch along that left wall. And right in front of me, at the foot of the bed, was a rocking chair. And it was sort of turned facing the sofa, and in the rocking chair, Grandpa always sat, and he always wore the same dark trousers, white shirt, black bow tie, black sweater, very dignified, very regal bearing, and he would smoke his pipe and rock and listen to the women, and every now and then he'd look at me, and his eyes would twinkle. He would never smile real big. Just a little play of a smile around his lips and twinkle in his eye. And I'd look at him and I'd get real bashful around him because I just thought he was wonderful. And anyway, so there's that image. And then one day, just on the other side of that sofa was a door, and it went into the kitchen. And along that same wall where the sofa was, go through the door, and then there's a little table, and it's a table for two. Well, beyond the other side of the door of the table was another door, and it led out to the back porch where, once they had indoor plumbing, the broom closet became the bathroom. And so to go to the bathroom, I remember one day in particular, I had to kind of brush past Grandpa sitting at the table to go through the door into the little broom closet thing. Anyway, I remember Grandpa looking up from his dinner plate. He hadn't been served yet. Grandma was at the kitchen fixing lunch. He was just sitting there, again, you know, in the same outfit he always wore. And I remember brushing past him, and as I got very close, I raised my eyes shyly, and I'm right at his shoulder, and he smiles, not the big smile, little twinkle at me, and I went on into the restroom. I remember that, I think, because I think that's the closest I ever was to him. I don't remember him ever holding me or anything. Anyway, I'm what, 5, 6, 7 years old, right in there. I go all my life with this lovely memory of that dignified, precious, twinkly-eyed grandpa. And then I turn what? I'm in my 60s. I'm visiting my aunt. And I say something about how much I just adored Grandma Delamater. That was her grandmother, actually my great-grandmother. And she said something, and then I said, but you know what? It was really Grandpa I adored, too, but I never remember him talking. And she said, well, I guess not, Esther. He died years before you were ever born. Now, that is not nice. That's not nice. Not at that stage of your life. No, 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 I was not prepared for that. You know, it's like hearing your best friend in your childhood or your favorite teacher was never there. I mean, I still can't believe it.
Well, now tell me, had Dean died by that point when you realized that you were seeing the ghost of your grandfather?
Let me think. I believe he had, yes. I believe at that point Dean was already gone, yes.
Well, why don't, you know, for the sake of our listeners, I have to keep reminding myself that, you know, maybe some of them haven't read the book. Tell the story of the day Dean passed and then you finding that story he had written as if he had a vision of his own passing. I think that might be a good place to start.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, golly. I'm trying to think how to abbreviate it, you know, because I don't want to take up an hour and a half of your hour show. Yeah, a few days after Dean died, I kept going into my office every day, and I really didn't want to. I mean, I didn't have my heart in it. And every day when I went in, and I keep a very neat office, very, very neat. Files go in files. I liked it to look pretty, pretty, pretty. I can't work when there's distraction with messiness. So it surprised me that every day when I would go in, I would see against the baseboard a folder. It was a clear folder, you know, about maybe 9 by 12 or I don't know. It was big. Anyway, I would just leave it there day after day. And finally, one day I came in and still there. And I said, well, gosh, I guess I better pick that up and see why there would be a folder laying on the floor against the baseboard. Who could have put it there? It wasn't there when I left to go to the hospital several days ago, because Dean was out of town in a hospital, and I didn't return until the day he died. Nobody had come in. Anyway, so I sat in a rocking chair, and I opened the folder, and I found that inside this clear plastic folder was a manila folder, and on it was written March 17th. And it was in Dean's handwriting. And I thought, what's this? And I open it, and it is something that he wrote, handwritten. It said, March 17th, I think it said 2 o'clock a.m., I just had a dream. Now, I'm paraphrasing myself, so I'm, you know, think I'm getting it as close to accurate as I can get without looking at my notes. But he said, I had a dream, and I just had to get up out of bed and write it down before it gets away from me. It doesn't seem like a dream. It seems so real. And I feel like it has some significance, but I can't imagine what. So then it began. He dreamed that he was 7 years old, and he was standing outside a hospital emergency room. And an ambulance had just pulled up, and attendants were taking a gurney out. And as the gurney came past him in the hall of the emergency room, he saw that it was him at his present age on the gurney. And he followed it into the elevator, and they took it up to ICU room 3. When he got up there, they took his grown-up self on into a room, but he stayed out in the hall because I was in the hall, and Larry, my husband, had his arms around me, and I was crying, and he was watching me. And there was a bench in the hall, and an old man was on the bench, and he said, "Dean, come here, I want to talk to you." And Dean said, "No, I can't talk to strangers." And he said, "Yes, I want to tell you something." So Dean went to him, and he said, "Do you see the rose there by your mother's feet? Bring it to me." And Dean went over, and he picked up the rose, but it was a broken rose. The stem was broken. He gave it to the old man, and the old man disappeared. And Dean didn't know what that was about. But he looked at the nurse's station right there beside him, and there was an intern or a young man in white clothes at a file cabinet. And he walked over to the man, and he said, "Can you help me? I'm very sick, and my mother is very sad. Can you help?" And he realized that the man didn't hear him. The man shut the file cabinet and walked away. So Dean went to the girl, the nurse, sitting at the desk, and she was writing something. And he said, "Excuse me, but my mother's very sad, and I'm ill. Can you help me?" And he realized she couldn't help either because she couldn't hear him. And about that time, bells began to go off in ICU room 3. And people began to run into the room, attendants and people that worked on the ventilator and nurses. And one nurse came, and they couldn't get the bell stopped. And Dean's watching as they all run into the room, ICU room 3. And a nurse runs in, she gets me. And I go quickly down the hall, and now everybody is in ICU room 3. Dean, the child, walks down the hall to ICU room 3, and he stands at the door. And the room was so bright with a light that he could hardly see. And at the foot of the bed appeared the most beautiful angel he could ever envision. And she held out her hand, and she said, "It's time, Dean." And Dean, the grown-up Dean, said, "What about Mom?" And the angel waited while the grown-up Dean wrote a note, and then the room grew very bright, and the grown-up Dean disappeared with the angel. Well, I'm reading this, and I can hardly believe what I'm reading. Dean died in ICU room 3 exactly a month later, April 17th, and he died under those circumstances, the ventilator, bells, everything.
So he had... He had a vision of his own passing.
Yes, but don't forget what I found after that. I found the yellow pad that he had written on as he was dying. And he asked my husband, he pointed, because he was on a ventilator, he couldn't speak, he pointed to a yellow pad. And I had gone downstairs for a cup of coffee. First time I'd left the room since he'd been in the hospital. And He indicated to Larry he wanted the yellow pad. Larry said, "Esther," Dean's eyes twinkled, I remember his words, "as if he had the merriest secret in the world." And I couldn't imagine why his eyes were twinkling so. And he wrote one word, and then he closed his eyes, and he smiled. He opened them, he wrote two more words, closed his eyes, and died. And, of course, the bells began to go off on the ventilator. A nurse came running downstairs for me. I came running upstairs. And then I got to stand next to him as he went to flatline. But later when I found the yellow pad among his hairbrush and Kleenex, toothbrush, toothpaste, I saw the yellow pad. And on it I found the two words. And the two words were angel, am eager. So I can't help but believe that that merry twinkle was because he had just seen an angel at the foot of his bed. And she said, "It's time, Dean." And he said, "What about Mom?" And she waited while he wrote angel. He closed his eyes, smiled broadly, opened up again and wrote, "Am eager," and left with her. So I can't tell you what a comfort it was to know that he had had that dream, written it down. And then I found a yellow pad that he wrote as he died that said, "Angel, am eager."
Well, and it didn't end there either, because after that, I mean, you'd think that would be incredible enough, but more things started to snowball after this. You,
yes.
You saw him a few times on the other side. Do you want to talk about that?
I'll talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Well, I think listeners would be really interested to hear about those two places he took you to. The place that was kind of desolate, that was otherworldly, and then the place that I think you described it more like an academy or a library.
No, it was like a huge lodge. It's something like I would associate with some old money in English, and I don't know. It was just like a huge lodge of some kind. But
why don't you tell those two stories and then explain how he has put you together with other people and how you are helping these other people through their grief.
Oh, dear. Dear, dear. Oh, where do you want me to start? At the time he took me to the strange place?
Yeah, and the lodge. You know, you can sort of give an abbreviated, account of those.
I don't know. Nobody who knows me has ever heard me give an abbreviated anything. And somebody once says, "I talked this long to a wrong number." Let's see, the strange one. About a couple of weeks, 3 weeks after he died, my daughter was living in New Jersey. And we were both not coping really well with this. And she wanted me to come out and be with her a little bit. So I did. And the first or second night, I was in the guest room. And I couldn't sleep. And the lights were off. And I remember thinking in particular what pretty lace curtains Brooke had put up at the windows, and the moonlight was filtering through it. And I was appreciating her sweetness. And crying my eyes out because I just couldn't believe Dean wasn't still with us. And I just said over and over to myself, "Oh, honey, if only I knew where you were. If I just knew you still were, you know, because Karen, we think we have all of this pretty well worked out in our head about what happens after you die. And then something so close to you as a son you just adore with all your heart is gone, you really question everything. You question everything you've ever believed. And you question whether or not there's really a God. And you question whether or not there's a continuation of life. Because you know he's not up there flapping around singing the hallelujah chord. He can't carry a tune. He's not going to do that. You start thinking about those golden streets, you know. He would have no interest in walking on golden streets. What is it?" So I'm thinking all of this, and I'm crying. And as I am, I feel a wind in my face that is so strong that it literally took my breath away. Have you ever put your face out of the window, like a Cocker Spaniel, of a moving car?
Mm-hmm,
you ever
yeah,
been
yeah.
in a situation, you know, where your breath is just taken away from you? That's how I felt. And I felt, even though my hair isn't long, I felt it being blown away from my face. It was the wind was that strong.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sitting up. I wasn't even lying down. I was sitting on the bed. And I remember going like that and wondering what was happening. And my heart started beating real hard, and I couldn't grasp what it was. And all of a sudden I had the sensation, and my eyes were closed because of the wind in my face, and I had the sensation of flying. And I could see terrain under me moving very swiftly. One scene in particular stands out right at the beginning, like going over a dark neighborhood street and the trees and the lights on in the houses, and I was very close to the dark street. And then I was over the trees, and then suddenly I remember seeing hills, and it was like it was night everywhere. Then I was going over huge canyons, and it was all so fast. This was in an instant, one image after another. And then all of a sudden, I was in space, dark space. And I couldn't tell if I was still moving because nothing around me moved, but the wind had ceased in my face. And I sort of caught my breath, and I was suddenly on a landscape that looked very much like our idea of a moonscape. And to my left was this gigantic boulder. It was like it was a big round boulder. And it must have gone up 20, 30, maybe even 40. I'm not good at that sort of thing, guessing how high, but huge boulder. And then I was standing there, and all these rocks and rubble, and it was sort of a blue silver. And on the far, far horizon, I saw a beautiful planet, blue and white, as if it's a moon rising. And I suddenly realized, it was so quiet, it was absolutely dead quiet. And I had the feeling that Dean was over my, would be my right shoulder, standing slightly behind me. And I said, "Where in the world are we?" And Dean said, well, first I said, "What's that?" Then I was looking at the moon rising, and he said, "That's Earth, Mom." And I said, "Where in the world are we?" Because I remember thinking, "Dear God, please tell me this isn't where Dean lives. It's tranquil and it's beautiful, but it's so lonely." So then I said to him, "Where in the world are we?" And he said, "Mom, this is where I come when I need to be alone and think." And zap, my eyes flew open. I was sitting on the bed. I was still crying, or the tears were still on my face. And I lay back, and I tried to take in what had just happened. I thought, what was that? And then I started crying again. And I said, Oh, Dean, darling, was that really you? Did we really go there?" And as I'm saying this, I felt a very firm, moist kiss on my right cheek. And I touched the place. I mean, there was no denying what that was. He kissed me goodbye.
Wow. That's pretty intense. And that wasn't the only time he took you someplace. So then he...
That was the only time I was awake.
So was the other time when he took you to that lodge, where you, was that from a dream?
I was asleep. It's one of those dreams where, you know, I think there are so many theories on this, but I think there are some well-placed theories here as we experience this. We don't know. This is always interesting to me, Karen, people that have the answers to things that they haven't experienced. You know, because I would have had a different take on it had it not happened to me. You know, somebody telling me the story, probably, to be honest, wouldn't believe it to in the way that I know it to happen when you experience it. I'd probably say they have a vivid imagination, or they wanted it to happen, or based on something they had been thinking about previously. But when it happens to you, you can't do anything but look at it in a totally new light, you know?
So how did, you know, what conclusion did you come to about the other side after that, you know, these experiences with Dean? Because you've seen him a number of times, and he's been sort of, you know, sort of like the chess master, I think, you know, moving you around in your life. And I'm hoping our listeners will go out and get your book to, you know, hear about all of these different, I mean, we can't possibly relate all the different times he has put you just in the right place at the right time to meet the right person.
Well, even meeting you, Karen, even meeting you. And here you were wanting to write a television series and kind of not knowing exactly how to go about it. And I think somewhere there, you know, Dean says, "Hey, Mom, Karen needs your help. I got to put you with somebody here for a minute."
Well, you know what? Let's take a minute because we have a couple callers, and let's see if the sometimes the people who call in would like to ask a question. Sometimes they're just listening. So let's try to connect with them and see if they have a question for you, Esther. And then
and I think
they,
Claire Applewhite wrote hers in, didn't she?
Well, I didn't get anything from her. Maybe she's one of these callers. Let's see.
No. I know where she is, and I have a copy of the question she asked.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll make sure you answer that for Claire over the air. All right. So here, I'm going to go to the first caller on the switchboard here. Hello, caller. You're calling from the 314 area code. Did you have a question for Esther?
Yes, I did. This is so interesting. I was wondering if she was going to be appearing or talking anywhere in, like, around the St. Louis area.
Yes. I just left St. Yes, I just left St. Louis. Who's calling?
Joe.
Yes, Joe, I will be there. September the 25th, we'll be doing a Sisters in Crime workshop, and then and then someone with your first name, Joe, Heistand, and I will be doing haunted venues in and around St. Louis on September the 26th through the 30th.
Wow, that sounds great. I'll try to...
So, Esther, how would Joe find, get more specifics? Is it on your website?
Yes. Go to Esther Luttrell. Let's see, there are a lot of places to go. EstherLuttrell.net. Has a list of places that we'll be going, and also spiritedmysteries.com, and also Esther Luttrell bookstore.com has Dear Dean Love Mom and lots of other wonderful books, including yours, come to think of it.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, Joe. Bye, Anna.
All right. Now let's see if this other caller wanted to. Caller from the 313 area code, did you have a question for Esther?
Is that me?
Yes, that's you.
I kind of tuned in a little late. Is Esther, is she talking to the people on the other side?
Well, she's speaking to her son, her son who has passed away.
Oh, okay. And I just was wondering, do she connect with anyone, or is this just her son? Or I just lost my husband.
Oh, dear. No, hon. What I found that Dean has been doing, it just happened this past weekend again, but he's been putting me with people who have just lost loved ones.
Yeah.
They come to me in the strangest ways, and I'll tell you about it in a second if we have time, about what happened this past weekend.
Okay, but yeah, because I just buried my husband Friday.
I think the message that Dean wants me to tell everybody is your loved one is alive and well and close to you and loves you and is really with you, not just with you in spirit or with you in your heart, really with you. And when something happens, if you get afraid or if you get worried, talk to him. He will be there. I think that's Dean's message over and over is, Mom, tell him. He's just done so many things that are tangible evidence of this, hon. So while we physically miss them so much, they're just fine. We're not fine because we want their physical presence.
True.
But they are fine, and they want you to know that they're even finer than they were the last time you saw them. But they're with you. They are right there with you.
Okay.
And he
Thank
may
you.
Let you know it, honey. Stay open and receptive to that, but talk to him.
Okay.
Talk to him a lot.
All right. Thank you
okay.
so much.
Thank
bye-bye.
You for calling in.
All right. Bye-bye.
So, Esther, you said that one of your friends emailed you a question they wanted you to answer on the air.
Yeah, I've had to run here to the to my email real fast to find it. Have you got something you want to say while I'm searching for it?
Well, you know, I think one of the other things that really attracted me to your outlook about all of this was that you really didn't have a definitive idea of what God was. You know, you weren't saying, you know, God is this you know, this, you know, wasn't Jesus or this man in the heaven necessarily. You were very open to the idea of whatever the universal source is. And so I guess, you know, if we have time, you know, maybe just sort of talk about, you know, talk about that a little bit. And you also had a pretty incredible experience, remember, with your back injury, and, you know, you were in such dire straits and you had this miraculous healing. Yeah. I mean, you've had so many incredible things happen in your lifetime. You have enough for a dozen people.
But you know what's funny is, gosh, I hope I can find this. I think, first of all, we all have experiences. I don't think I'm one bit unusual. We all have them. A lot of them, I think we sort of just say, oh, wasn't that unusual? And we don't realize what a miracle that we've just experienced. That's just my own theories. But I don't think I've been unique at all, because I think everybody experiences all these things, honey. And I don't know that it's up to me to explain God.
Well, you know, of course, we're not asking you to be an expert. We're not asking you to be an expert. We're just, you know, talking to you as someone who has tuned into the other side, and you've had this miraculous healing experience, and I don't know. I think listeners would really be interested. I was intrigued reading all of that. You know, how you had such faith and how things, you know, actually happened for you. And so, if you haven't found the email, why don't you tell us?
I did.
All right. Let's do the email and then we'll get to the rest.
Okay. She said, "Hi, Miss Tate. My name is Clara Applewhite. I'm a friend, a colleague of Esther's. Read her latest book and loved it. As I'm going to be at a book signing this evening at 6 p.m., I'd like to submit these questions in advance. How did you feel when you first suspected that Dean was trying to contact you? For those of us who suspect we are in the same shoes, what advice would you offer?" Oh, gosh, Claire, thanks. "How can one be certain, or at least somewhat certain, of the message that a loved one is trying to convey? There must be a lot of confusion at the time a message is coming through. How do you interpret messages from Dean?" Well, good grief, we got another 6 hours to do this show? Oh, boy. Okay, where do you want to go from here, honey?
Well, we have to answer Claire. Well, I mean, I imagine it must be very difficult in one's grief to not just be so overwhelmed with the grief that you can't open yourself up to subtle, I'm assuming, subtle things that might be happening. I mean, I imagine somebody would have to hit me between the eyes with a 2x4.
Oh, I think
know?
That's what Dean did. I mean, I'm not going to be one who goes outside and I see a rainbow and I go, "Aunt Elsie's here." You know, "Oh, Aunt Elsie loved rainbows. She must be back from the grave." I would never assume. Dean really did have to do something pretty dramatic and drastic. And then I didn't get it. And then once I got it, I didn't get what I was supposed to do with it. And then once I figured out what I was to do with it, I didn't have the courage to do it because I was so afraid that people would think I was nuts or lying. You know, that I, it wasn't until just last year, and Dean died in 94, but it was only last year that I had that one incident that I end the book with, the man at Barnes & Noble.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought me home to really sit here in this very chair and do some heavy thinking. And my thoughts were, my God, shame on me, that I would come to this planet, live this life, be given these experiences, and not have the guts to share them with those who need to know, that I would keep it to myself and die, an old lady, just because I'm afraid of what people would think. And you stop and think, you've been given an assignment. You've been given a very important mission. You know, we all say that we hope our life means something, that we've come here and that we mean something. And here I was content to just live and breathe and die and not do the one important thing that I'd been given to do out of fear. And when I realized that I had to just chuck it all and say, no, I have to say this. This has been happening to me since 1994 for a reason. And it hasn't stopped because Dean hasn't given up on me.
Well, you know, Esther, I can understand you being a little apprehensive because, you know, some people start saying, oh, it's of the devil and all of that crazy stuff.
Or new age. I don't understand any experience being new, old, middle age. I mean, it's an experience.
But all you have to do is turn on television, and people are so intrigued by the paranormal and the other side. They're hungry for this because, you know, so many of us just don't know, you know.
Yeah, but Karen, for everyone who's hungry for it, there is somebody out there who's going to tell you a lie because for 10 minutes they want to be a star, and that scares me too.
Well, you know, all you can do is tell your story.
That's right.
And I think your sincerity and your genuineness just comes through. And we have another caller. Let's see what they want to ask. Hi, caller from the 706 area code. Did you have a question for Esther?
Yes. My husband died in 2004, and I was sitting here listening with my heart in my throat, and I heard her say something about Aunt Elsie.
I know that accent.
And I'm in Georgia, and so I knew I was supposed to call. He was really present with me last year, but this year, are there times when you sense Dean's presence more than others? Are there long spaces of time in between? I mean,
well,
has my husband gone away?
First of all, Elsie, I don't pursue Dean. You know, he has to hit me over the head. I don't go. He went for a long period where he gave up on me. I know he did. All these things were happening. I wasn't getting it. And I think he just disappeared on me. And that went on for about 3 years. I wasn't aware of Dean in any way. And then what I end the book with is an incident that happened at Barnes & Noble's that was so blatantly Dean's work that I realized when I got home I was to write that book, that that's what it was all about, was getting the message out. So what was the question?
She wanted to know, do you go for periods of time when you don't know or think he's there with you?
Yes, because he only lets me know he's here when there's something I'm supposed to be doing about it.
Well,
I mean, he doesn't just come and visit me and have tea and stuff. No.
Oh,
yeah.
Last year I was planting my garden, and I wanted some corn seed, and I found some in between his shoes in the utility building. And I was planting my garden again this year and wishing he would show up. So I guess I don't control it. He does, right?
That's what I think. I think the whole thing is to, but I think finding the corn between his shoes,
right.
While I don't want to, you know, say that Aunt Elsie is in every rainbow, or that if a butterfly appears, you know, that's Grandma. I do think if you're thinking specifically like you wanted corn and you find seeds between his boots in the utility room, that's pretty significant to me.
And he bought me a sandwich for lunch one day because I was out and so busy and so hungry, but I didn't have any money. And then my eyes locked on a little change purse in my car that had been there when he drove it to his brother's and died. It just been there, and it was just enough money to buy me a sandwich.
I didn't know that. That sounds crazy, doesn't it? No,
but it made me feel
crazy.
Good.
Nothing's crazy. But, you know, I think here again, I think everybody is surrounded by loved ones. And in our rush, I think sometimes we miss the significance of what's just happened. And I think because of our physical yearning for them, I think that sometimes we're sort of numb to the fact that they are trying to reach us and let us know.
Right. Well, okay. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
You.
Okay. Bye.
Bye, honey.
So, Esther, what were some of, I mean, you've already said this experience where he sort of took you to, you know, a planet where you could see Earth. But aside from that profound experience, what were some of the other things where you knew he was at work? I think if I remember the book right, you actually physically saw him out the window, right, one time, right, with a woman he had put you together with her son. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the first experience. I had already found the dream, you know, in the folder, and I found the yellow pad, but I hadn't had any experiences with him, and I had decided that I would, since he was an aspiring screenwriter, that what I should do with his insurance money is go across the country and help others like him, because I hadn't done near enough to help him. I could have done so much more. But he was so young, and I thought we had oodles of time. I would do it later. And so when he died at 28, and I was just struck by how little I did for him, then I realized that I should take his insurance money, go across the country, and help other aspiring writers like he was. Do for others what I wish I had done for Dean, is how I put it.
Well, now tell us about that experience where he took you to the lodge.
Well, wait. You want to hit that one, or when he came in person?
Okay. I'm sorry. Let's do the one when he came
right.
in person.
Which cares?
We'll get to both of them.
On this one, anyway, so one of the places I was going to go was, the first one was going to be held in Kansas City, and then I was going to Austin, Texas. And we put a little 2-inch ad, 2 column inches, in a Kansas City paper and in the Austin paper, but no place else. And yet one day, before I'd been on any of these, the phone rang, and it was a woman who said, she introduced herself, and she said, "I'm not crazy. I don't want you to think I'm crazy." She said, as a matter of fact, and she went on to tell me her credentials, that she was involved in a lot of social things, and she was very involved with her community theater and all sorts. And I could tell she was a very cultured lady with a very cultured voice. So I didn't think she was crazy, but she said, "I don't know why I had to call you." And it turns out she was in Florida, and I was in California. And she said, "I saw your name and your phone number. It was in some magazine." She's in Florida. And she said, "I had such a physical reaction to it. I began to shake, and I just had to call and say, why in the world would I have a reaction like this? Why would I need to call you? Why do I feel compelled?" And I had never had a call like that at that point. And I said, I'm sure I don't know. And then she said something like, "Maybe I just overreact to everything. My son just killed himself, and I'm distraught, but I'm not crazy." And I said, "Oh, your son just killed himself. I'm so sorry. My son just died, so I certainly understand your grief." And as I said, then she started telling me about her son and how he killed himself, and he was very young. He was 19, I think it was. Anyway, as she's telling me, I'm standing at my desk, which is in front of a big window overlooking my driveway. And as she's telling me this, I'm standing up there. I've got the phone to the ear, and I just happened to glance up. And as I did, I looked out the window, and there was Dean, just on the other side of the window. And beside him was a young man. And the young man had his left elbow up on Dean's right shoulder. And they were just grinning at me, grinning ear to ear. And I remember saying to the woman on the phone, she was talking, and I said, "Oh, my son's in my driveway." And she said, "What?" And I said, "My son, he's in my driveway." And I remember she repeated that after me, "Your son's in your driveway." Because I said, "And he's got somebody with him, a young man." And my brain is scrambling, and I'm thinking, that must be her son. I mean, what else? I don't know who that is with him. It must be her son. And my brain was just a jumble of thoughts. And I'm looking at Dean, and he's grinning, and his eyes are just twinkling. And this young man next to him has very deep dimples, and he's grinning too. But anyway, I said to the woman, may I describe the young man with him? And I went on to tell her that he was wearing an aqua and white striped T-shirt. It was vertical stripes, not horizontal. I remember telling her it had something where the pocket would be, but it wasn't an alligator. Remember how people were wearing those alligator T-shirts there?
Mm-hmm.
For a but it wasn't an alligator. It had a little white collar. He had on blue jeans and tennis shoes. And I described his hair, which was a light brown or a dark blonde. And it was looked like it was natural curly. It came to the top of his collar, but it was very neat. And I said he had deep dimples. He said, from here it looks like he has hazel eyes. Now, from here would be maybe he's 8 feet in front of me on the other side of the window, both of them, maybe about eight or nine feet ahead of me. So it was, you know, I could see them very well. And then the woman just gasped, and she said, that's what he was wearing when he died. And I don't remember the rest of our conversation. I was so fixed on watching Dean and this young man grinning at me and getting such a kick out of my reaction. And then when she said that, then they were gone. But I had quite a while there to watch them and to describe them. And it was just as three-dimensional as my grandpa had been.
So, Esther, So how would you describe what your mission is? Is it to reassure us who are here still in flesh and blood and living that we have nothing to worry about, that there is going to be something on the other side and that our loved ones are there waiting for us?
You know, I wish I knew the answer to that. I've often asked myself, would what I've experienced be true for everybody? In other words, is Dean just giving me an example that it holds true for everybody? Because I don't know. All I know is that the people he puts me together with, like the father I talk about at Barnes & Noble's, and like the woman at the Mount Dora supermarket whose husband had just died, I know specifically those people were put in front of me, and I was to tell them, your loved one is right with you. And you're not separated. Life goes on. But I don't know. I don't know beyond what he's let me know, you know?
So I guess at this point, though, I mean, it must have taken away your fear of dying.
I never had a fear of dying. I have a fear of being mangled. I have a fear of being sick. I have a fear of being incapacitated, but I don't really have a fear of, you know, once it's over. You know, sometimes when I'm really sick and I think, okay, this is the big one, you know, I'm going, then I think, okay, all right, now, let's see, John Kennedy did it, Elvis Presley did it, Jesus did it, okay, I can do this, you know. It's like taking a deep breath and going to jump in, you know, something cold and wet. Here's the thing I don't really understand about us that maybe Eastern cultures have over us, is that it's inevitable that we're all going to pass through this phase of life to something else, whatever. What a shame that we're taught that it's something to be so horrified of, and not really from the time we're born, to be tempered with the knowledge that it's all in divine order. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That the first part of your life is the learning process. The second part is the provision. The third part is the preparation for the next journey. I wish we learned that our life should be compartmentalized like that, because what we do with it, it seems from the time we're little until we die, we're just sort of scratching and surviving and clawing. And it's all so difficult. And then we have this horror up ahead, like we're going to run into a tornado, rather than being taught to live gracefully, knowing that there is a final resolution that is not final at all, except to this phase. Does that make any sense?
No, it does. It does. You know, I think it reassures that when the lights go out, they're not out for good, you know,
it's,
that it is just
the
end transition.
Of Act 1 or Act 2 or Act 99,000, whatever act we're on.
Well, and I know myself, Esther, I don't know if I've ever told you this. I mean, I got so much from the book because Dean seems to be having such a good time on the other side.
Doesn't he, though? Yes. This is like Joe that just called earlier. When I was talking about doing haunted venues, I think people probably go, oh, my God, she's going to talk about her son as a ghost. No, I'm not. Dean absolutely adored Halloween. He would spend weeks preparing sound effects for people at the door. He loved it. And so going out and speaking in haunted venues, and I was asked by the Atchison Chamber of Commerce to come there and speak at their Glick Mansion and give a ghostly talk. And I thought, well, I can't talk about my book. Dean isn't a ghost. He's a vision, or I don't know what he is. He's a presence, but he's not a ghost. And then I started thinking, I could just see Dean laughing. And he thinks, go, Mom, do it. That'd be fun. And I thought, okay, that'll be the tie-in. Dean adored a good ghost story, so sure, we'll go do this.
Well, Esther, we probably have about 6 or 8 minutes left. What do you think is the most important thing for you to leave the listeners with, besides what you've already shared with us?
Well, I don't think there's much new I can say. I think I can reiterate it again, and that's just that it seems to me from what I've been shown is that, first of all, I think our priorities are all screwed up. I think we think that everything that is troubling us right now is the total of our existence, and really it's just a glitch. It's just a glitch. I can't think of anything so severe that it isn't just a glitch. And I think that we should be, if we can, strive always to put our mind on a higher plane and just know that everything is in divine order. I don't care how it looks. It is in some kind of divine order.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me, you know, because, you know, myself even, and, you know, not talking about a deceased loved one, but just horrible things that have happened. In the moment, they're the most horrible thing in the world.
Yes,
but maybe
yes.
A year later, you see the silver lining in the cloud. You see the gift that it really was.
It's like, how could anybody ever say anything good could come out of Dean dying? How? How? I loved him so much. How in the world could that be good? Well, because I'm probably closer to him now, even than when he was alive, and we were very close. But my goodness, he would not have been able to show me so much that I in turn could show others had he not been where he had a bigger vantage point. And I think he's getting a tremendous kick out of sharing everything and seeing that I do too. I think he's just getting the biggest kick out of this.
So do you have any other insight that you can share in terms of what else you think he's doing on the other side, aside from connecting you up with the right people? How does he spend his day?
I have no idea. Oh, Lori, no idea at all.
Well, you know, you did. You did mention something to me about you wanted to say you thought we're made of star stuff.
Yeah.
Did you want to close? That sounds like a positive note to close on.
Well, I just think that we are. I think that we tend to look down rather than straight out or up. I think our life is so taken up with the struggles of our existence that we really forget what lovely, creative creatures we are. We're really remarkable, and we have so much more to offer, so much more fortitude, so much more strength than we allow ourselves to believe. We can get through anything. We can do it. But it doesn't seem it while we're doing it. And, you know, I keep thinking, am I going through this for character? You know, I'm tired of character. Can I just have some peace and quiet in my life? I don't want any more challenges to prove what character I've got. I don't want any more character. But I think everything is, is really in divine order. We're going through a terrible, I think something terrible. If we look at it in earthly terms, it's going to be quite traumatic what we're coming up to in our earthly existence. And you can see it with the finances and the governmental things. It's going to be a tremendous shakeup. Now more than ever, we need to know a couple of things. Number one, we have the strength to endure whatever we need to endure. We have the creativity to meet the challenge. And also, whatever we're used to, let go of the railing. We can skate without it. Whatever that security blanket was, we don't need it. Because we do have all of the love from everyone we've ever loved is still around us. There's still a God in place, and I don't know if he is an old man on a throne or not, but I suspect not. It's just that we need not to be so darn fearful and to hang on to things the way we do.
Well, you know, I think that fear comes from our disconnection from the source. You know, we used to, so long ago, think, you know, we were taught that we were part of that cosmic web, you know, that we were all interconnected. But unfortunately, some of our religions have told us otherwise, and I think that's just has us in a very fearful place.
Well, you know, somebody asked me, I gave a talk at the library not too long ago, and when I opened it up for questions and answers, one woman took me a little bit by surprise. She said, was Dean a Christian? And I think everybody in the room sort of held its breath to see how I was going to answer. She certainly did take me from left field. But I said what I believed. I'm not sure Jesus would even understand what we call Christianity today. I think that we have so polluted the word. If you're saying, was he a spiritual person, would he have said, how would Gandhi have handled this? How would Jesus have handled this? Yeah, he would. But I don't think that I understand the power play that has been made of the word Christianity. Does that make any sense at all?
Oh, absolutely. It's the difference between the, you know, the man-made dogma in the institution and the authentic reality that is the divine source. I mean, I don't think the two have much to do with one another.
No. And I think the people who are touting Christianity, some of them are doing it with the best intentions, but I still think it's a power play.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to remember there really isn't anybody between us and God. There's
well,
no
you certainly,
intermediary. Huh?
Well, you certainly found that out in your miraculous healing, which I'm going to tell listeners they need to go buy your book to hear about, to read about.
Well, you can buy the book on my website. It actually, you can buy it online at Barnes & Noble's. I don't think it's in the stores yet. But certainly online at Esther Luttrell Bookstore. And while they're there, they should look for your book.
Well, thank you, Esther. Well, I would imagine they could probably go to any online seller or probably any bookstore can probably order it too, right?
Yes. It's my publisher is with Ingram's and all of the places that the bookstores have. But, you know, our print world is just changing drastically, and how we acquire our books is even going to change drastically. So right now I've sort of protected myself, and I say just get them off of Esther Luttrell Bookstore, and I'll be sure you've got them.
All right. Well, let's give those websites again. You have the Dear Dean Love Mom website, and you have Esther Luttrell Bookstore, and I'll spell your name, EstherLuttrell, bookstore.com.
Right.
Well, Esther, thank you so very much for being such a delightful guest, and I think this is really important stuff, and you have to know that you're giving so many people comfort, and I want to just thank you for that.
Well, it isn't me. I appreciate Dean not giving up on me in all those years. I think I finally got it, and I hope I'm telling it right. And thank you for letting me do this.
Well, and you know, if you have any more insights, I hope you start a blog or you do book two. You know, I think you are divinely connected and very humble about it. So just, you know, thank you so very much for sharing your story and not, you know, for having the courage to come out and, you know, and not you know, keep it to yourself. You're doing everyone a really big service.
Thank you. Thank you a lot, hon.
All right.
Okay.
Well, good night.
I'll be listening.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye, hon.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, too, whether the Great She be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks will save the world. And you've just been listening to Esther Luttrell. She is the author of the very touching and intimate book, Dear Dean, Love Mom. And we've been discussing her paranormal experiences and insights since the death of her son, Dean, and her glimpses into the other side. So thank you. Thank you very much, Esther. Well, listeners, we are crossing that threshold into the bottom of the hour, and I'm going to take a very brief one-minute music break to get ready for the What's the Buzz segment. And for that minute, let's see what I'm going to choose for you to listen to today. How about Breath of Passion by the wonderful group called Zingaya? So stay with me. I'll be back in 60 seconds. You know what that sound means? It's time for What's the Buzz, the segment. When I tell you about the bees buzzing around in my bonnet all week, well, we're going to start with Belgium banning the burqa, and will Europe follow? This comes from an examiner.com column, one of my favorite writers, Micah Stone. He's the Portland Humanist Examiner, and he says Belgium will be the first European country to ban the burqa in public spaces. In Brussels, the capital of Belgium, the country's lower chamber of parliament overwhelmingly approved a bill to ban the burqa on streets, parks, sport grounds, and buildings meant for public use or to provide services. The burqa is an Islamic garment, he says, worn by women that mask the face. Many see the garment as a symbol of the oppression and second-class status of Muslim women. Others claim that because the wearer is not fully identifiable, she could be a threat to public security. They claim the new law will be useful in the fight against terrorism. Women will still be allowed to wear the hijab, which only covers their hair, in public places. The ban will forbid any veil or scarf that covers the face and prevents one from being identified. France and Austria are both considering similar bans on the burqa. France is the home to Europe's biggest Muslim minority, and tensions between Muslims and non-Muslim Europeans continue to escalate, not only in France, but through the European Union. And it might be interesting to note that President Sarkozy, president of France, actually said in his opinion that the burqa is not just a dress, it is a statement. And his attitude is, if you want to live in France, it is an egalitarian, secular country, and you have to get with the program. And so, you know, that's part of it is banning the burqa. Quebec also is moving toward this as well. Also from Micah, he tells us that Al-Shabaab continues to stone men, women, and children to death in Somalia. Recently, a 13-year-old Somali girl was stoned to death after being gang raped. The girl was buried in a hole up to her neck and then stoned to death by 50 men while over 1,000 spectators looked on. Al-Shabaab, if you're not familiar with it, is a radical Islamist faction controlling much of the region in southern Somalia. And their brutal interpretation of Sharia law is responsible for multiple stonings in the last few months. Just last Tuesday, Halima Ibrahim Abdurraham, age 29, was stoned to death after having been convicted of adultery in a village called El Ban. Earlier this month, Al-Shabaab stoned a man to death for adultery but spared his pregnant girlfriend until she gives birth. After she gives birth, she too will be stoned to death. Somalia's president, Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed, a moderate Islamist, accuses Al-Shabaab of spoiling the image of Islam by killing people and harassing women. He says, their actions have nothing to do with Islam. They're forcing women to wear very heavy clothes, saying they want them to properly cover their bodies, but we know they have economic interests behind this. Some say they actually sell these kinds of clothes and want to force people to buy them. What a racket. Well, wouldn't be the first time somebody used religion to make money. Let's see. Then back here at home in Florida, Florida Senate Republicans are pushing anti-abortion legislation, but the House Democrats are pushing back. Republican majority Florida Senate pushed three separate anti-abortion measures through last week. Two of the measures are amendments to a larger health bill. One of these amendments passed in a 24-11 vote, mostly along party lines. Forbids state or federal funds for the use of abortions, except in cases of rape or incest or endangerment to the mother's health. The second amendment passed on a 22-17 vote, which would require women to pay for, and in most cases, hear details about ultrasound exams. The cost of the ultrasound exam can vary between $200 and $1,000. According to the Orlando Sentinel, State Senator Nan Rich, a Democrat, said, "It's actually, to me, the ultimate insult to women. It's saying women can't make up their own minds, can't use their own judgment as to what they want to do with their bodies. The legislature is making a medical decision for women." House Democrats have responded to this 11th-hour amendment by refusing to continue operations as long as the Republicans keep pushing the issues of abortion and ultrasounds. For the time being, House Speaker Larry Creetle, a Republican, called a recess, and House Democrats intend to continue the use of this tactic until the session ends Friday. Democrats hold 44 seats in the state House, and Republicans hold 76. Let's see, then the third, State Representative Kelly Skidmore, a Democrat, told the Sun Sentinel, quote, "We have very little leverage in this process. This is our only leverage, so we're willing to let our bills die to prove our point," unquote. The third measure is a bill that would treat a fetus as a person for the purposes of homicide. The bill would add unborn child to the definition of a person for the purpose of a homicide under state law. A fetus is considered viable after 24 weeks. However, according to Miami Herald, Democrats argue this would challenge the precedent set by Roe v. Wade and would be a setback for reproductive rights. Well, I guess Republicans are not going to stop until women have to resort to back alley abortions again, and Roe v. Wade is a thing of the past. You would think we would be moving forward. Instead, sometimes it feels like when it comes to women, some of these people think all we are incubators for the male seed. Let's see. Now we're going to move to the UN. There's outrage from feminists and Iranian women's rights groups worldwide. They wrote an open letter to the UN opposing Iran's candidacy for to participate on the Commission on the Status of Women. The letter references that Iranian women have been arrested, beaten, and imprisoned for peacefully seeking change of discriminatory laws in place in Iran, and also states that the Iranian government will certainly use the CSW membership to curtail the progress and advancement of women, reports Radio Free Europe. More recently, a senior Iranian cleric created a firestorm when he blamed earthquakes on women's attire. He said women who do not dress modestly lead young men astray, corrupt their chastity, and spread adultery in society, which increases earthquakes. That was actually reported in the Washington Post. So yes, these Iranian women's rights activists and feminists are right. We do not need Iran with these barbaric, prehistoric ideas on any commission that is in existence to uplift the status of women, because it certainly is not their agenda. Quite the contrary. New changes in the U.S. Navy. Women will be allowed to serve on submarines now. The U.S. Navy announced last week that women are no longer banned from military submarines. The first woman will begin serving in 2012. The change was announced immediately after a 30-day waiting period for Congress to object. But this expired. So since there were no objections, this will actually go into effect, and the policy will be changed. And we're flipping back and forth between home and other parts of the world, but an investigation is being launched into Nigerian parliamentarian's marriage to an underage girl. Formal investigation into Nigerian Senator Ahmed Yarima's alleged marriage to an underage girl was launched last week by Nigeria's parliament. A local newspaper reported yesterday that Yarima claimed his new wife is actually older than 13, but did not specify her age, according to the Washington Post. He reportedly paid a dowry worth $100,000 to the girl's parents and brought her from Egypt to Nigeria, though reports indicate the girl is still in school in Egypt. Yarima, the senator, is 49 years old and has three other wives. And he told the BBC, quote, "I don't care about the issue of age since I have not violated any rule as far as Islam is concerned. History tells us that the Prophet Muhammad did marry a young girl as well. Therefore, I have not contravened any law, even if she is 13, as it's being falsely peddled around," unquote. Nigerian Women's Affairs Minister Josephine Ania told reporters that if it is true, then it is very objectionable, very obnoxious, very condemnable. It is something we cannot condone or allow to happen in this country. And, you know, not to mention, girls this young, if they get pregnant, you know, it's a danger to them to deliver a baby, not to mention the psychological harm. So this is just unconscionable. And, you know, what kind of guy would be so desperate that, you know, he wants a 13-year-old girl and not a grown woman? You have to really wonder about someone who would do something like that. That's just abuse. Then in Afghanistan, dozens of Afghan schoolgirls were gassed, and so were their teachers. At least 88 schoolgirls and teachers have become ill after suspected poison gas attacks at three schools last week. All three schools are in the Kunduz province in northern Afghanistan. They complained of a strange odor in their classrooms before they fell ill. And after the initial treatment, fortunately, they were all in stable conditions. A similar incident occurred last year when more than 150 students were hospitalized after three separate incidents during which students became ill soon after reporting strong odors. Well, and if you haven't been keeping up with stuff like this, there are many places in Afghanistan and in other Islamic countries where they just don't want the girls to be educated and to send them to school. So you find things like this happening to scare them, to discourage them from getting an education. In Taliban-controlled areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan, violence against schools that educate girls has been a key part of campaigns against the education of women. In Pakistan's Swat Valley, more than 130 primarily all-girls schools have been destroyed, allegedly by the Taliban. In total, hundreds of schools have been destroyed in Pakistan's northwest region over the past several years. During the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, which lasted until 2001, Afghan girls were forbidden to attend school. To date, more than 1,000 girls or co-ed schools have been bombed or burned in Afghanistan. How very unfortunate, and we have to be aware of this. Oh, Okay, so let's see. Now we're back here in the United States again. We're bopping back and forth like a ping pong ball, but I hope you don't mind. Walmart, they have been caught. Court of Appeals approves a class action sex discrimination lawsuit move forward. That's happening in San Francisco's Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. They voted 6-5 in a ruling that means a gender discrimination lawsuit filed against Walmart can move forward to trial. According to the Washington Post, the class action lawsuit was initially filed in 2001. By Betty Dukes, a former Walmart employee, and six other plaintiffs who worked in 13 of Walmart's 3,400 U.S. stores. The plaintiffs claim that men systematically earn higher wages and receive promotions at Walmart, despite women's competitive quality of work and seniority factors. Duke said in an interview with ABC News that she knew at the end of the day a male was going to have the position, and if you make too much noise, you could just put your job in jeopardy. Co-lead counsel added to her story when asking why they didn't get a promotion that went to a man. The women were told management is men's work, not women's work. You should be home taking care of your family. Marsha Greenberger of the National Women's Law Center told ABC, "I can't imagine a bigger message than being sent to bigger employers and to employers overall that big companies need to be held accountable and the laws do apply to them." Is that not just medieval dark ages too? I mean, don't they realize that a lot of single mothers are supporting families? That's just insane. Hawaii's legislature approved a civil union bill. The Hawaii State House voted in favor of legalizing civil unions after an unexpected decision by the bill's sponsor to revive legislation. The House voted in favor of the bill 31-20, and the Hawaii State Senate voted in January in favor of legalizing unions in the state with veto-proof 18-7 vote. Only 13 votes were needed for the measure to pass the Senate. The civil union legislation would grant both gay and straight partners the same rights and benefits, according to married couples in Hawaii. So good for Hawaii. They care about equality. Now, this is very interesting, I thought. It's an alternate article by Tim Wise, and you can find it on alternate.com, because I'm not going to read all of it. I'm just going to give you snippets of it. But it says, what if the Tea Party were black? Interesting, huh? Well, Tim says, let's play a game, shall we? The name of the game is called Imagine. The way it's played is simple. We'll envision recent happenings in the news, but then change them up a bit. So let's begin. Imagine that hundreds of black protesters were to descend upon Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia, just a few miles from the Capitol and White House, armed with AK-47s, assorted handguns, and ammunition. And imagine that some of these protesters, the black protesters, spoke of the need for political revolution and possibly even armed conflict in the event that laws they didn't like were enforced by the government. Would these protesters, these black protesters with guns, be seen as brave defenders of the Second Amendment, or would they be given by most whites, would they be viewed by most whites as a danger to the Republic? And what if they were Arab Americans? Because after all, that's what's happened recently when white gun enthusiasts descended upon the nation's capital, arms in hand, and verbally announced their readiness to make war on the country's political leaders if the need arose. Imagine, too, that white members of Congress, while walking to work, were surrounded by thousands of angry black people, one of whom proceeded to spit on one of those congressmen for not voting the way the black demonstrator desired. Would the protesters be seen as merely patriotic Americans voicing their opinions, or as an angry, potentially violent, and even insurrectionary mob? After all, this is what white Tea Party protesters did recently in Washington. Then imagine that a rap artist were to say in reference to a white president, quote, he's a piece of shit, and I told him to suck on my machine gun, unquote, because that's what rocker Ted Nugent said recently about President Obama. Okay, so let's imagine a bit more. Let's imagine that a radio host were to suggest that the only way to get promoted in the administration of a white president is by hating black people. or that a prominent white person had only endorsed a white presidential candidate as an act of racial bonding, or blamed a white president for a fight on a school bus in which a black kid was jumped by two white kids, or said that he wouldn't want to kill all conservatives, but rather would like to leave just enough living fossils, as he called them. So we'll never forget what these people stood for. After all, these are things that Rush Limbaugh has said about Barack Obama's administration, Colin Powell's endorsement of Barack Obama, a fight on a school bus in Belleville, Illinois, in which two black kids beat up a white kid, and about liberals in general. Also, imagine that a black pastor, formerly a member of the U.S. military, were to declare as part of his opposition to a white president's policies that he was ready to suit up, get my gun, go to Washington, and do what they trained me to do, unquote. And after all, this is what Pastor Stan Craig said recently at a Tea Party rally in Greenville, South Carolina. Imagine a black political commentator suggesting that the only thing the guy who flew his plane into the Austin, Texas IRS building did wrong was not blowing up Fox News instead. This is, after all, what Ann Coulter said about Tim McVeigh when she noted that his only mistake was not blowing up the New York Times. Imagine that a black liberal website posted comments about the daughter of a white president, calling her typical redneck trash or a whore whose mother entertains her by making monkey sounds. After all, that's comparable to what conservatives posted about Malia Obama on FreeRepublic.com last year when they referred to her as ghetto trash. So, to ask any of these questions is to answer them. Protest is only seen as fundamentally American when those who have long had the luxury of seeing themselves as prototypically American engage in it. When the dangerous and the dark other does so, however, it isn't viewed as normal or natural, let alone patriotic, which is why Rush Limbaugh could say this past week that the Tea Parties are the first time since the Civil War that ordinary common Americans stood up for their rights, a statement that erases the normalcy and Americanness of blacks in the civil rights struggle, not to mention women in the fight for suffrage and equality, working people in the fight for better conditions, and lesbian, gay, and bi folks as they struggle to be treated as full and equal human beings. And this, my friends, is what white privilege is all about, the ability to threaten others, to engage in violent and incendiary rhetoric without consequence, to be viewed as patriotic and normal no matter what you do, and never to be feared and despised as people of color would be if they tried to get away with half the stuff these people do on a daily basis. Interesting food for thought, isn't it? And I'm sure most would have to agree things would look really different if it wasn't all white folks who were out there doing this teabag stuff. I wanted to share with you what came in across International Gay Rights, 5 hours of trying to rape a lesbian straight. Very sad. This was at Gay Rights. .change.org, and it talks about the corrective rape epidemic of South Africa. Millicent Galika, a 30-year-old South African woman, on Friday night was walking home with some friends after a night out. As they approached their house, a man outside asked if anybody in the group had a smoke. Millicent did. So she stayed outside with the man, someone she knew, and allowed her friends to walk on. A few minutes later, the man locked Millicent in his apartment, beat her, raped her, and she screamed during the whole ordeal. And he responded by saying, "I know you're a lesbian. You're not a man. You think you are, but I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you that you're a woman. I'm going to make you pregnant. I'm going to kill you," the man yelled, as he raped Millicent for 5 hours, trying to make Millicent straight. Well, if you think this story sounds horrific, multiply it by 520, as that's the average number of stories of corrective rape reported in South Africa each year, according to ActionAid. And that number doesn't account for the dozens, if not hundreds, of other cases of corrective rape that don't even get reported. In South Africa, there's an epidemic of rape geared toward lesbian and gay people, particularly lesbians, in an effort to turn them straight. Yet while countless organizations and reports have been labeled corrective rape a nationwide problem, South African authorities have not yet done enough to hold perpetrators accountable and curb corrective rape's rising tide. And as any logical, insane person would say, it's time to demand justice now. Well, I think I'm going to end What's the Buzz Tonight on a positive note. And this came out of opednews.com, and it addresses how women in Norway, in corporate Norwegian boards around their country, are making a positive contribution. And we know about it because the SEC has had to adopt, you know, here in our country, has had to adopt new diversity rules. Anyway, this article by Stuart Bramhall is titled Addressing Corporate Fraud, Norway's 40% Female Solution. And I'm going to give you just snippets of it, not the whole article. But it goes on to say that we're learning the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, is filing a lawsuit against Goldman Sachs for misleading their investors, and that was good news. But less well-publicized are the new diversity rules the SEC has introduced for the 2010 proxy corporations sent out to shareholders. The rules, which propose to address Wall Street's malignant don't ask, don't tell culture, require companies to disclose to shareholders that they have considered diversity when selecting candidates for board positions. Well, the author of the article says he strongly suspects this move was influenced by Norway's 2003 law, which has been copied in several other European countries, requiring that corporate boards be 40% female. Interestingly, the arguments for implementing Norway's 40% law were based mainly on economic considerations rather than gender equality. Their outlook was this. They said as women began to graduate from university in higher numbers than men, scores of college-educated Norwegian women with business experience who had no chance of being selected for corporate boards was viewed as a wasted resource. As Anne Skor Gabrielsson, the conservative trade minister who drafted the legislation, put it, what's the point in pouring a fortune into educating girls and then watching them exceed boys at almost every level if when it comes to appointing business leaders in top companies, these are drawn from just half the population, friends who have been recruited on fishing or hunting trips, or from a small circle of male acquaintances? Another major impetus for the law were theoretical and empirical studies showing that diversity promotes innovation and resilience by broadening the range of debate. Many saw the example of the United States as one they did not want to follow. Well, even in Norway, when this first came about, not surprisingly, there was considerable backlash against the law mandating that women make up 40% of corporate boards. Their most common objection was that there were insufficient qualified women in Norway. There were also dire predictions that replacing male board members with female ones would cause boards to lose their expertise, that shareholder confidence would plummet, and that overseas investors would withdraw their holdings from Norway and take them elsewhere. Well, 4 years into the program, they're saying that making the 40% quota mandatory, and none of the direct predictions have come to pass. Norwegian businesswomen respond to the new law by creating a plethora of women-focused executive search firms and training, mentoring, and network programs. Moreover, most of the 300 women who have taken seats on Norway's are better educated and qualified than the men they actually replaced. And despite the lack of empirical data, anecdotal feedback, and qualitative data from Norwegian CEOs about the addition of women to their boards has been positive. Executives are pleased and surprised that women, unlike many of the men, do their homework and read management reports prior to coming to board meetings. In general, they are better at working as part of a team. This may relate to different communication patterns, which have been studied in other contexts. Although there is a lot of individual variability, social psychologists find that women tend to be invested in ensuring everyone has a chance to speak, whereas men tend to be invested in advancing their own position. Women also appear to be more sensitive to divided interests in boardrooms and to ethical issues such as fraud. And Norway isn't alone. In 2007, Spain passed a law requiring that 40% of corporate board members be female. Germany and the Netherlands are following a similar course, commencing with voluntary agreement companies. Can sign committing to improving diversity. At present, France is debating a law that would make gender equality quotas on corporate boards mandatory. Well, one has to wonder if there were more women on Wall Street, would we have just had that debacle, or if, women wouldn't have been such casino players and risk takers. Well, that concludes our What's the Buzz segment for tonight. And as long as you keep telling me that you like What's the Buzz, I'll keep shedding light on ideals of the sacred feminine, which are being honored out in the world, or ideals that are being oppressed. We have to be aware. We have to keep pushing back. We have to know what's going on across the street and across the globe. Greed and the desire for power over others is pervasive, and people who measure themselves and their value by the size of their bank book, they're not just going to roll over and give up their influence and control. We have to be aware. We have to counter their toxic strategies and the imbalance and disharmony they create. And that means you and me and our like-minded brothers, and we will. We will do it with our thoughts, our words, and our deeds. As we will it, so shall it be. And I like to repeat that every week. So with that being said, the bees are released from my bonnet for yet another week. Well, getting on to the announcements, I'm planning a sacred tour for women and men to goddess sites of Turkey for October 2011. So stay tuned or keep up with developments on my website. This journey to Turkey, which will be my third, is intended to be a very experiential journey, complete with hamams or Turkish baths that will help us get into our bodies and experience the magic that Turkey has to offer. We'll do dream journals and meditations and rituals at the sacred sites. We'll visit awesome archaeological museums and places like Chateau Hayuk, where we believe egalitarian societies, people who honored a gender partnership, lived and worshiped goddess. And I'm only planning to take about 20 people, so be thinking if you want to be one of our pilgrimage group, and it is for men and women. Speaking of Turkey, if you're in the LA area, don't miss the Anatolian Cultures and Food Festival in Orange County, Irvine, this weekend. It'll be great fun. Think of it as a warm-up to the Turkey tour. Roy and I attended last year, and we really enjoyed it. So think about that. This is the only weekend that that it happens. So that's May 6th through 9th. And speaking of pilgrimage, I've been invited to give a workshop at her church, the Feminist Lutheran Church in San Francisco, on May 16th. That's next weekend. So if you're in the Bay Area, please come. The workshop will be about the art of sacred pilgrimage and esoterica of sacred sites of goddess. It's going to be a workshop for both your left and right brain, I promise. And let's see what else. Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, that class, the session 2 starts up again this Saturday at the Goddess Temple of Orange County in Irvine. These next 6 classes, which can be taken individually or not, you can take it as a series, either way, will be covering Judaism and Christianity and the lack of female imagery and presence in those two monotheistic religions. May 8th, the session is about the Hebrew goddess. May 22nd, Sarah the priestess. June 12th, the Apostle Mary or Mary Magdalene. June 26th, the Virgin Mary. July 10th is witchcraft. And the final session of part 2, July 24th, is called Intentions, how we start to create our new world view. And at the end of that last session, we are going to have the temple graduation party. All right, what's next? This is the final weekend, if you're in the Los Angeles area, to go to the Craft and Folk Art Museum, where they're having their exhibit called The Fool's Journey, The History and Symbolism of the Tarot. And the Getty Museum has an exhibit called The Aztec Pantheon and the Art of Empire, running through July 5th. And from the description, they're having works on display from the National Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City, and excavations from Templo Mayor, which is smack dab right there in Mexico City as well. Both certainly should include artifacts of goddess. I can't imagine that they won't. Let's see, I want to make sure you know what our lineup of guests are going to be for the rest of the month. I got that right here. Next week, we have with us, we have from England, Mary Sherrod. She is the author of Daughters of Witching Hill, and she's going to be calling from the UK and discuss the women who inspired this piece of historical fiction. Then May 19th, we have with us a longtime teacher within the women's spirituality movement and foundress of the Women's Mysteries of the Ancient Future Sisterhood, Vajrama. She's going to discuss women's natural spiritual authority. Vajrama is a priestess, educator, sacred dancer, shamanic healer, minister, and performer. And finally, to end the month, we will have the wonderful producer, Roberta Canto, with us. She created the three-part documentary Blood Time, Moon Time, Dream Time. It's an incredibly important resource for women and men everywhere to help us reclaim our life passage rituals and the power and sacredness of our bodies and our sacred blood. So please tune in every week, and as I always say, if you can't catch us live, please do catch us from the archives. You're welcome to send in questions in advance, and you know, I'm happy to ask the guest questions if you'd prefer not to actually call in and be on the show live. Well, that is a clue that we are coming to the bottom of the hour. And I want to thank everyone for tuning in with me tonight and my wonderful guest, Esther Luttrell. And for tonight's words of inspiration, I invite you to close your eyes and take a deep breath and sort of come to an even deeper focus and awareness. As I read for you the original Mother's Day proclamation that dates back to 1872, and it was written by Julia Ward Howe. And this is what she says in honor of Mother's Day. Arise then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts, whether your baptism be that of water or of fears. Say firmly, we will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands shall not come to us reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We women of one country will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them solemnly take counsel with each other as the means whereby the great human family can live in peace, and each bearing after her own time the sacred impress not of Caesar, but of God. In the name of womanhood and of humanity, I earnestly ask that a general congress of women without limit of nationality may be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient, and at the earliest period, consistent with its objects, to promote the alliance of the different nationalities, the amicable settlement of international questions, the great and general interest of peace. So those are the words of Julia Ward Howe. 1872 and still so relevant today. You know, let us remember we not only have to be educated, we have to be informed and aware. We have to know who has our best interests in mind and who will use us and then throw us under the bus. We have to know what's going on out there in the world, even when it's easier to just bury our heads in the sand because it feels so overwhelming at times, or so complicated, or so divisive, maybe even helpless or hopeless. And dare I say, we take it a bit farther than just being informed and aware. We have to reclaim our sacred feminine voice. You've heard me call it the roar. I've talked about it in the context of the ancient Greek priestesses and how they serve humanity, and I've likened it to the roar of Sekhmet. The great she, and by extension us, women everywhere and our like-minded brothers, must hear the call, must claim our roar, our voice. When the great she roars, she is saying, I am alive, I am here, I am growing stronger every day. I offer you the tools for a sustainable future. I offer women empowerment and men partnership. I provide all you need for a joyful and abundant life. Hear me roar. And we are her voice, her hands, her feet in this life. This too is what the Dalai Lama meant when he said Western women will save the world. So women, men, stand up, speak up, work together and support other women. Change the world. Goddess is the dark horse coming from behind to win the race. Well, listeners, I'm going to say goodbye for another week, and as I do, I'd like to leave you with a musical piece to close the show, and I think what I'll choose is Corn Mother by Lisa Thiel. So thank you for tuning in. Hope you'll be back with us next Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. Till then, let me leave you with this oldie but goodie. It's our marching mantra, and it goes like this. Not the church, not the state. Women must decide their fate. Good night, and may the great she embrace you in her golden wings.
Well, the best of the